You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
My name is Eric Dinkus. I'm with the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. I want to thank everyone for coming today. We're very glad to have members of the European Parliament here, and we hope everyone enjoys this event. Thank you very much.
So I'm Juliana Grunwald with National Journal, and I'm going to be moderating this event. So our topic today is e-commerce and the European Union's approach to these issues. They're tackling many of the same issues that the United States and Congress are tackling as well. Privacy, piracy, a whole range of issues, patents. So we're just going to dive right into this, and I'm going to start off by asking a few questions. Today we have Malcolm Harbour, who's a Member of Parliament from the UK, and he is the Chairman of the Committee on Internal Market and Commerce Protection, which deals with many tech issues. And we also have Mr. Pablo Arias Echeverria, who is also a Member of Parliament from Spain and coordinator of the Working Group on E-commerce. So I'm going to start off on the issue of privacy. One of the most recent issues the European Commission has taken up is revisions to your privacy directive, which, among other things, calls for a right to be forgotten. Can you talk about some of the proposed changes and how they might affect U.S. companies and other non-European companies? Maybe Mr. Harbour, you can start off with that.
Okay. Well, it's great to be here. I'm very sorry to hold up the start of the meeting, but we've been to the Commission of Consumer Product Safety Commission this morning, which is somewhere out of town, as you know, so it's always quite difficult to schedule meetings. I can put on record that my committee, which I'm proud to lead, is the biggest delegation we've ever had for the Internal Market Committee here. But we managed to squeeze in 13 meetings with senators and congressmen over the last 2 days, which apparently is a record for a European parliamentary committee, so we've been taking our work seriously. But anyway, I'm delighted to be back at Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee meeting. I've worked with Tim Lawdon for many years. I know he's sadly not able to be with us today, and I probably met a few of you at a number of meetings that we've held over the years here. Now, on the broader issues that we're tackling, and we can start with consumer protection first of all, but before I do that, perhaps to set that into the broader context of the work that we're doing in my committee on the digital single market, because we have been taking that very seriously and looking at the integration between the different elements of proposals. We're not responsible in legislative terms, the lead legislator for all of them, because that's shared among a number of parliamentary committees. So those of you that are following that closely will know there's a lot of parliamentarians, for example, working on issues like data protection. Pablo Arias is one of the senior members of our committee, has been leading an initiative that we've started to try and integrate work policy together. So he's going to be co-sharing the workload with me. But I think that it's really important to look at all of these issues in the context of making the single market move forward. And I preface that, Chairman, because there's been a huge amount of interest in data protection here, but it's not the only thing we're working on. And it's not actually, I would say, absolutely the predominant issue, though it is an important one. Now, where did we stand on that, and how is it going to move forward? The Commission has made a proposal. It's a radical proposal. The last time the data protection legislation was reviewed and agreed was back in 1995. You need to look at it in context of the fact that we passed in my committee in 2009 a separate proposal on e-privacy, data protection for electronic communications providers. And some elements of that, particularly things like data breach notification, were actually issues where we consulted fairly extensively in the US on, because the US in many ways set the lead on that. I know we're looking at comparative issues today, but I just want to put that on record, actually, that it was the US that led on data breach notification issues. That is now being carried over into the broader data protection issues. This does not actually work specifically for electronically held data, though, of course, that will be the predominant use of it. It's about data that anybody holds for commercial purposes, any type of data. I think the important things about this proposal from our perspective as the Internal Market Committee is that it is a single unified regulation, which means the provisions would apply, if agreed, in every country of the European Union without modification. In other words, it's not a framework directive where member states are asked to modify their national laws to achieve the outcome. It's actually going to be a single unified regulatory proposal. Now, it'll go into effect in each country at one time with a single regulatory framework, with data protection controllers in every country implementing it and collaborating with each other to implement it, which means the companies who are operating in the European data space can nominate one person as their compliance officer, effectively, and that will apply in different areas. So the rest of my colleagues are just arriving because we rushed ahead to get the meeting started. Now, that is a really important development. Whether the 27 member states will agree to that is not yet clear. We've only just started the discussions, but I just put that point on the table because it's important. Now, alongside that, of course, we have the idea for a unified regulation with unified regulatory framework. Alongside that, there are a lot of other detailed legislative proposals. Now, the stage at which we're at the moment, frankly, is that we are working through those now and taking a view on them. We have, in my committee, a rapporteur working on it. We have a number of us working on it. The lead committee is our Civil Liberties Committee. That gives you an idea about how it's seen in a European space. But essentially, everything is open at the moment. And those of you that are interested in sending in submissions, now is the time to do so, as far as the Parliament is concerned. There's already been several rounds of consultation already. So that's where we stand. I mean, we're interested to hear your views about it. And I think also about how that relates to some of the developments that we see going on in the United States.
Well, can you talk about how, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, if you're an American website and you can be accessed in Europe, you're subject to this regulation, correct? And maybe can you just give a couple points of what the regulation would do? Maybe.
Well, I think it's too complex to just talk at this stage about a number of points about what it would do. As I've just said, you know, it's still in progress. In operational terms, it will mean that if you operate in Europe, if this goes through, if you're operating in Europe, you will have one unified set of rules to deal with. Now, I mean, the core elements, I think, will not be that different from where we are at the moment. There is that customers, as you know, consumers in Europe, first of all, if you want to include them on your marketing databases and send the messages, they have to opt in and not opt out. Nothing will change there. That remains a fundamental difference in philosophy between the US and in Europe. Secondly, they are entitled to know how you're going to use the data and what you're going to use it for, and essentially give their permission for that. If you want to use the data for something else, you have to inform them and give them the opportunity to consent to that. Now, there are a number of other issues about storing your data and storing your transactional data and how much of that you can then request to be deleted later, which has been brought into prominence, particularly by social sites and so on. That is one of the issues that certainly is important. And we already have, I remind you, from the 2009 directive, new provisions for website operators with cookies in Europe, where they are now being given much more transparency about the cookies that you're putting on their computer to encourage the transaction between themselves and your website. And there was quite a lot of controversy about that. I remember when I last came here. But actually, now that's actually being implemented, and certainly from the UK users, and I don't know about other countries, that we're getting a very simple message saying, if you're going to continue to use this website in the way you did, you now need to look at the cookies we're putting on and give us your consent to put them on. And if you want to understand further, most of the websites will give you a list of the cookies that they're putting on and what they're being used for. And on many websites, you can choose to reject some of them but to accept others. And I think that's the sort of consumer transparency that we will be aiming for with the general directive as a whole.
You'll be allowed to send your data back and forth. Now, I think a question a lot of people have is, will the safe harbor remain in effect after these changes to the directive go through?
Well, I mean,
do you think that it needs to be? If we well,
course it does. I mean, yeah, well, of course. The Safe Harbor Agreement was negotiated at a time under the previous set of legal requirements. Now, when we have a new unified regulation with new requirements in, I mean, clearly the Safe Harbor requirements are going to have to be looked at. I think that we're rather hoping, though, that if we work together on the concepts around this unified regulation across Europe, I think it will provide basically a blueprint that other countries might well want to follow in terms of a global set of internet standards. Now, I mean, it was interesting when we went to meet the chairman of the FTC 2 days ago, he made a number of points to us. The first one is the FTC has taken action against countries in the US for non-compliance with the Safe Harbor Agreement. In other words, that the FTC is already looking after European consumers by taking action against people who are not complying with the Safe Harbor Agreement and holding data in the US. We weren't aware of that, actually, and we said to him, this is something that European consumers would like to know, that you're looking after their interests. Secondly, that the FTC has published a very comprehensive sort of model code of conduct for privacy, online privacy, which I think has been well accepted. Now, I mean, we need to, obviously, as part of our work in amending the Commission's proposal, have a good look at that, because if we can align those principles in our directive with what the FTC has already published, it would mean that a new safe harbor agreement would essentially have been driven by that shared set of interests. I'm not necessarily saying that would be possible, because we weren't actually aware of that until we came here, which is part of the value of these visits. Well, of course, but I mean, you seem to be surprised about it. The whole regulation is going to be completely reviewed. Let me emphasize where we are. We have a completely new regulatory proposal on the table. It's not yet agreed. Our Parliament, as a co-legislator, with 27 member states, will be going through it line by line. We've started that process. The outcome I can't predict to you. I think I have an idea about what things will be amended, but it's not for me to say. That's open, and you can participate in the process. We encourage you to do so. Now, clearly, the Safe Harbor Agreement will be looked at after the new regulation comes into place, and in the meantime, things will operate as they are now.
One of the reasons why privacy legislation hasn't moved here is that critics say that it's going to stifle innovation, it's going to hamper the growth of this economic engine of the Internet. Obviously,
first of all, thank you for inviting me to this forum. Let me start to saying that, first of all, I would like to apologize because my English is not as perfect as my colleague. I'm not British. Second, I would like to tell you that it's nothing new. It's nothing that you don't know. Things are changing very fast. We have proof today. British were not punctual. And I was here on time, start saying this. It looks like things are changing and are changing very fast. But let me continue with sharing with you an experience, okay? And apologize for don't answering your question yet, but
I didn't really give you a chance.
So the experience start with a bath. With a noisy bath, okay? So it was a bath, a very irritating bath, but it sounds to me familiar. It was a very loud noise that woke me up this morning. It was the alarm of my smartphone. So I start my day today with that gadget, with my smartphone. After that, I connect my tablet to the network, to the net, and I have read the newspapers today. I have checked my email. I have read an email from my wife that is coming today to New York, and she was in the airport waiting for to catch her flight. I found a video in a message from my wife with my four children saying hello to me, and it was very nice. And this is a little photography of the familiar that we are already with the new technologies. 10 years ago, it was not possible to even think about all these things. It was a dream, and probably not many of the people that are in this room were familiar with having WhatsApp, to having an iPhone or a smartphone with many applications that will help you in your daily affairs. I have, for example, this morning changed my train with the application from Amtrak, just because I'm taking a train today to New York, and it was very helpful to have an application just to do that without calling an operator, waiting online, going to the station. So things are moving fast. Everything is changing, and everything is very helpful. It's very helpful on the digital era. But there are a few problems that we have. We have many natives of internet, as I can see here. There are many young people in this room. But for the ones that are not natives, it's not as easiest as it is for a native to use the new technologies and the new gadgets or whatever. So what are we trying to do now with all this photo? Why I'm telling you all these thoughts and all these experiences that we probably have during the day? And, well, I'm telling you this because internet is not perfect. We used to have many barriers in the real world, in the physical world, and those barriers are still existing, and also we have implementing those barriers in the internet. Why? Because internet has its own barriers that we have to defeat or try to defeat if we are interested in that. Internet. Yeah, of course. Internet has a characteristic that probably everybody should agree with it. It has a global character. The globalization is something that is brand new. But now we can share information very quick with other parts of the world. We have the possibility to trade with other commercial areas in the world. And the competition between the different companies is much stronger. Is much stronger than it used to be because probably the speed of the digital era and the digital sphere that we have now. So, in terms of trade, for example, we have the traditional barriers in Europe. We have a fragmentation market that is called the unified European market. That is, in my opinion, just an idea because we didn't we haven't we don't have all the potential of a unified market in Europe because it's fragmented and it's not a real unified market. But in a digital way, we have the same barriers for trade online, and it's a contradiction. Because if we are saying that internet has a global character, why we cannot trade online in a digital market between the different countries without the barriers that we have already? Just to put an example, we have a fragmentation in VAT, in postal services, in intellectual property rights. If we focus in VAT, for example, make you an example, we have 27 different ways of VAT in the one for each country because it's the country the one that make the VAT or put have the right to I don't know exactly the word but committee. But if we go to a physical format or to the electronic format, if we talk, for example, about books, physical books or electronic books, we have a directive from 2005 that tells the different countries in the European Union that you can apply a VAT for electronic contents from a minimum to a maximum. The minimum is 15% and the maximum is 21%. But if we go to the past, to the traditional VAT, to the physical format, the minimum is 4% and the maximum is 21. So what is going on? That, for example, in Spain, we have super reduced VAT for books because it's a cultural thing, and we think it's something that it has to have reduced VAT in a physical format, 4%, in an electronic format, 18%. The same book, the same content. Why? It's an example of the different barriers that we have already in the physical market and the new ones that are in the digital market. So,
is there an effort to sort of treat the digital and physical goods the same way? This is a debate that's going on here.
I know. I have read an article about the VAT 3 days ago in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was. We're very familiar about what's going on here with the taxation in online. Why? Because in my opinion, to sell products online without tax, it has been very good for the commerce, for electronic commerce in the United States. Why? Because it has, in my opinion, promote the channel. Of course, it's something that it has to change, because it's not fair that the ones that are in the traditional economy are paying taxes for the budget of public affairs, and the ones that are on the digital economy don't pay for it. But I know that is a debate that you have opened. But for example, the problem in Europe is the opposite. We have taxation that is in many times higher online than the one that is in the traditional economy. So I think that everybody needs a balance on that. I think that that the SMEs that are selling products in just one state, for example, also online, they have to pay taxes because they have physical stores on that state. That's why they are trying to go out of the state to. But the solution that the government is trying to get on that, I think, is vital. I think it's vital because, in my opinion, the digital economy is.
Treat both goods the same way.
Yeah, I think that the digital economy is not only the present is going to be. Growing, as everybody knows, in the future as an incredible situation, and I think that to get money from the taxation in the transactions online is vital for everybody.
Well, I want to switch to a different topic.
Can I just answer?
Oh, yes.
No, because you asked a question earlier that neither of us might, I think, answered, but you said had. Privacy law in Europe based on opt-in and on more information transparency to consumers held back the evolution of the online market in Europe. I think there's no evidence of that whatsoever. In fact, I would rather argue the contrary if you look at consumer surveys, is that actually, first of all, I think consumers like the fact they're not receiving a lot of spam. And secondly, I think they feel that they are much more inclined to transact on the internet with people whom they trust and where they know that their data is being used in the appropriate way, and issues about online payments and other things we have to talk about in VAT. So I think it comes back to what I said in my opening statement. The evolution of the digital single market is a whole range of interlinked issues, and
we have in many cases to look at how the physical market works and not get too hung up on the fact that it's digital in front of it.
So you believe that having some basic baseline rules gives consumers in Europe more confidence that, you know, when they do a transaction online, that their data is going to be protected, that it's secure, that, you know, someone's not going to steal their credit card number. Exactly.
I think all the evidence is there. And what I think is interesting coming here is I think quite a number of players here are actually doing that voluntarily because they see it's good for business. And that's an important development. You may argue with me when we come to the debate, but I mean, that's just my perception coming here from Europe.
I hear something about the cookies and the manage of cookies is something that, in my opinion, is good for the companies, but is not that good for users. Just to tell you, I have stole a cookie from a lunch bag. So if somebody is missing his cookie, I apologize, but it was just me. So the cookies is something that, in my opinion, doesn't make confidence in internet. Why? Because now things are moving, but since the time as I know internet, I didn't know what kind of cookie and what kind of information those cookies are taking from my site as a user, just as a user. So I know it helps a lot the innovation. I know it helps a lot the companies. I know all that. The marketing online is not possible probably as we know it without the cookies and so on. But I think you have the same problem here, but in Europe we have a very strong problem on confidence online and also in confidence on making any transaction online, to do commerce online for the users. And this is because the people is not custom, is not familiar when they trade without seeing the face of the one that is trying to sell a product to them. So that makes a lot of people in Europe nervous. So if somebody is telling you that you have something that has an incredible word, that is a cookie, everybody loves cookies, I think it's very intelligent to use that word. And somebody's telling you, well, you have a little spy in your PC, in your tablet, in your... he's going to have many doubts about what's going on in his transaction, about the data that cookie is taking from inside and who is going to have that information about the person. So in my opinion, we need a balance on it. And, I repeat, things are moving, and I think it's an open debate that we must take care of it because it's very important.
Well, I'm going to switch gears from privacy to piracy. The Parliament made headlines earlier this month when it rejected the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. Maybe you guys can talk about where you stand on that agreement, and sort of what message do you think that sends to people that might want to promote other future agreements dealing with
I think we should say, by the way, that we're joined by a number of distinguished colleagues. Can I just introduce them briefly so you know who they are? So we have Maria Eregion Perez, if you want to just, from Spain, Morten Lukegaard, Vincenti Garces from Spain, and Ivo Kuznick from the Czech Republic. And many of them, and Heidi Ruler, who is out of my sight background there. So we have the Green Party, the Socialist Party, the Liberal Party, as Morten says, the true liberals, the true economic liberals, and the Conservatives, which is Edward and myself. The Parliament as a whole was involved in this debate. I'd say it's not been a responsibility of my committee. It was the International Trade Committee. So what I'm going to say is largely my personal perceptions. We've had some lively debates on it when we've been here this week. I think that I don't think that it should be construed as sending any signals at all to the fact that we become less tolerant of intellectual property violations. And I think one of the problems with the rejection of ACTA, because I think it presents some problems, even though I was in favour of allowing it to continue to be with a referral to the European Court of Justice, but people decided that it was time to finish it. But I think the problem is that ACTA's reach was so broad-ranging that the only element of the discussion that precipitated its rejection was about online. There are huge problems about counterfeit transactions in the physical world, some of which are very harmful to consumers in terms of drugs, unsafe products, unsafe toys, unsafe car parts, unsafe airplane parts, I could go on, and all of those are covered by that. But the political debate, the campaigns, the global online campaigns, were all centered simply on the digital element of it. So that's the first problem. And I think, therefore, he didn't actually get a fair hearing. But having said that, politically, that's not an excuse. I think the real problem was that the agreement in terms of our parliament was not one in which our parliament really felt that it had any stake in it. We were invited to approve something in which we had no engagement. And certainly a number of congressmen and women that we've met, I think, here, feel the same thing. So I think the lesson really is that if we're going to move forward on these areas, that actually it's not just executive decisions. I think they have to be developed with engagement at a political level and to deal with those issues. And secondly, that I think that the distinctive characteristic and issues around online transactions, online piracy and other things do need separate treatment from dealing with the undoubtedly problematic issues of intellectual property protection overall. I'd say it's my own personal view, I hope we can make some progress on that.
So do you feel like those types of issues dealing with just online should have been stripped out?
I think we needed two separate proposals. I think we needed two separate proposals, yeah.
So do you feel like it was a victim of the whole debate that we encountered here in the United States earlier this year over the anti-piracy legislation?
No question. Exactly. It was a victim of that. There's no question about that. And not just of that. The telecom package that I talked about earlier on with the changes that we brought in was also delayed by 6 months with a similar level of online campaigning, because that also coincided with the activities, in particular in France, about the so-called Hadopi law, some of you may have been familiar with. And there was an election going on there, and there was a huge amount of activism around that. Now, in that case, we successfully resolved that because it was only an element of the telecom package, which actually had nothing to do with copyright at all, but was hijacked in that respect. In this case, I think that we have to go back to first principles, but I think the elements of the ACTA ideas related to dealing with physical goods I would give priority to, but I would then develop that with much more parliamentary engagement and then have a look at the issues online that need to be dealt with. Well, at the moment, any enforcement actions related to online piracy are the responsibility of the 27 member states, because, these come under the justice systems of individual member states. There isn't a sort of pan-European movement or drive around that, and some member states are coming up with individual proposals, the UK government, the French government, and other governments as well. So that's not happening in a coordinated way in that respect, because there are different traditions and different legal systems and different legal processes involved. And I think that's going to continue. There are some other broader things that can be worked on in terms of using customs cooperation and other things, but again, those are targeted at physical goods. So there is a lot of concern and activity about counterfeiting. We've established a new observatory to collect some data and information about that, and all these things will continue to move forward.
Now, another issue, what you guys have taken maybe a different approach is on this idea of net neutrality, of ensuring that the internet remains open.
What do you actually, can you define that neutrality for me and what you mean by keeping the internet remaining open?
Well, I mean,
it's difficult for legislators if you can't even define what you're talking about. So you tell me what you mean. No, that's not true at all, actually. I mean, I would say that the FCC has followed us.
Okay.
There's a lot of... The trouble is that this is the whole issue about net neutrality, I think, is what it means in the first place. No, in the 2009 reform, which I remember talking about when I was here in 2010, and some of you may have been here, we had a lively lunch debate in another part of town, laid down specific provisions which the European regulators could use to deal with discrimination, or shall we say discrimination by quality of service provided, in other words slowing down or blocking traffic that will be faced, that could be used in an anti-competitive way, and that provision was clearly set out in the Universal Service and Users' Rights Directive, for which I was the rapporteur, and that is now being implemented. If those of you who really want to, and I suspect there are quite a few internet neutrality junkies around here, so if you want to send yourselves to sleep, I point to the fact that a couple of weeks ago, the body of European regulators for electronic communications, which is an important body that was brought into being by the 2009 reforms, has published a whole set of papers about their examination of net neutrality across the 27 European regulators, and providing some guidelines about how regulators can use the provisions they have in the existing regulation for dealing with what they see about anti-competitive blocking. And I remember, as I remember saying at the time, and I just note from the VEREC consultation, that we think in a European context, and I emphasise this European context, that it's going to be competition that's going to discipline operators and ensure the best offers for consumers, but only if there is effective transparency to consumers about the offers they receive and also about what management conditions that any of their operators might impose on them, and that was included in the Universal Service and Users' Rights Directive, and also to give consumers the ability to switch providers easily in that context, and particularly in broadband. Now, you have to remember that that is in the context of a European marketplace in which we have mandated access to next-generation networks, where network providers are required to open networks to other competitive providers under the famous fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms. And interestingly, the Commission also produced an important communication last week, which you may have said, which basically reinforced that and made it absolutely clear there was going to be no regulatory holidays that open access would maintain. Now, our view from the European regulatory perspective, which I think is reinforced by this, and I don't think anything has changed, is that we've put the regulatory provisions in place because we see that there might be problems evolving here. We have open competition in the networks, and we don't see the need for incremental regulation. And I think it's an irony that, given that sometimes Europe is being accused of over-regulation, and I was interested to see that they're hearing here up on the Hill about consumer protection, about privacy, data privacy, where there was some congressman saying we absolutely don't want these horrible European solutions, that it's interesting that there's some scepticism that we're under-regulating on net neutrality. Well, I would say give us a break. Let us get on with this, because I think that we've actually tackled this the right way, and let's wait and see what happens. But anyway, all of these papers here, there are three consultation papers, and your views are welcome to BEREC. It's open until the 31st of July, so before you go on your summer break, you can send in your responses. And they are interesting papers. I must admit, I didn't manage to read all of them on my way across the Atlantic, but I did manage to get through the first one.
Thank you.
since that's the first time I've heard of it, so the answer is I don't know. And I mean, I suspect it will be in the European courts before too long. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait to see what the courts have to say about it. On the first side, I'm not entirely sure what element of EU law says that filtering by default is against. So I think, but we'd have to look at that. But I mean, thank you for confirming my point that issues in Europe are being dealt with on a national level according to each distinctive tradition.
Is that a problem? I mean, if you have one court saying, you know, a German court saying one thing and another court saying another?
Well, I mean, we'll wait to see. Who is it a problem for? I'm not sure.
Business across Europe, isn't it problematic if you don't know which law you need to apply? Can you abide by it?
Say something about it. I'm not sure if it's a problem or not. Concrete example. Okay. What is a problem is, as I said before, the fragmentation of the market. The fragmentation of the market in Europe. We have 27 mini markets inside the European Union. Okay. So one of the actions that we are trying to do is trying to simplify legislation, just to make the legislation that is just at a national level, just to make just one for the 27 mini markets, simplifying the problems, not just for companies but also for users or consumers. One of the problems that we have, I'm going to give you an example about property rights. The companies that are leading the sale of contents in Europe are American companies. Are Apple, eBay, no, Amazon. And why they are leading this sale of digital contents? Because they are enough big to sell their products in the 27 different markets in the European Union. What happens with our SMEs? Well, our SMEs, they would like to sell their products in the whole European Union, but they cannot because the barriers that exist in the European Union. So what we are doing in the institutions is trying to solve those problems, trying to defeat those barriers, and try to make a good scenario for us or SMEs to compete with the same opportunities with the giants of internet. So I can tell you that a Spanish company that was a video club online, it was, in my opinion, one of the good ones, but they didn't have enough economical muscle to implement the web as a pan-European level. So after 2 years of trying to find a partner, they just sell the company to a Japanese international company that is the owner today of the 100% of that company that used to be Spanish. In my opinion, that's not good for the European companies and for the economy in Europe. I think it's a problem. I can tell you that one of the formulas that we are trying to activate in Europe is SMEs plus internet is equal more growth and more employ. So with that, that is very simple. We are trying to prepare the scenario that at the moment is not a good scenario for the companies. A good scenario for the future for companies to have the capacity to sell products as a pan-European level without problems. Today, for example, example, in the US, if you want to, if you are from New York and you want to open a web to sell products, you open a web with .com, and you can sell products all around the European, the US country. In Europe, if you are from Spain and you want to sell your products in Spain, you have to open a web with .es, that is Spain, but it's not Europe. So if you want to sell products in Italy, you have to open a new one with .et. And if you want also to expand and go to France, you have to need to open a new one. So an example for that I can give you, I'm not sure if you know a Spanish company, it's in textile sector, is Inditex Zara. I'm not sure if people know Zara here. It's a huge company, an international company from Spain. They decided 2 years ago to start selling online in Europe. They spent 12 million in do that. 12 million for a big company is peanuts, as you said. Peanuts. But 2 years after that decision and after 12 million of inversion, they are only selling in 14 countries in the European Union. So almost it's like 1 million for each country. It's a lot of money for an SMS. Not for a giant, but for an SMS, it's a lot of money. And they cannot spend that money. So I think that that's a photography of what is happening, what is going on in Europe and the barriers that we have. I mean, in the sector of the contents, in intellectual property rights, that's the problem that we have. That's probably why you have the new of the that you have shared with us. But,
colleagues want to talk about that. The Moisés Lecaard is the vice president of our committee on culture, media, and sport, which deals with some of these issues. Did you want to add anything more? You're right. You will indicate to me if you want to come in. Catch my eye.
Are you talking about protectionism?
Answer is that in many areas we are looking at it more systemically. One of the most interesting developments, by the way, if you want to look at what I think is a good, very good piece of policy work, is the European Commission published in January, I think it was January, a very good paper confidence and trust in the digital single market, which range widely over issues that affect consumers' confidence and trust in the marketplace. Now, I just come back to what I said at the beginning. I think it's very important in these sort of gatherings that we remember that a lot of the issues that consumers face have nothing to do with the digital technology at all. They're good old-fashioned issues to do with retailing and supply of goods. So if you look at, and there's been quite a lot of material published by the European Commission's Consumer Scoreboard, which you can also look at, and indeed our committee, by the way, and you can find this on our website, which is on the European Parliament website, which is europarl.europa.eu, which is the EU domain name, that we published a study about consumer behavior in the digital economy as well, where we collated a lot of this material together. But let me just give you a simple example. One of the biggest areas which consumers are worried about when they're shopping on the internet is one, whether the goods will be delivered at all, whether they'll be delivered on time, whether they'll be delivered undamaged, and whether they'll be delivered to the specification or color or size that they asked for. Now, you know, these are the sort of issues that most consumers are worried about. If they've already got through the barrier of interacting with a trusted provider. There's sort of two things related here. A trusted provider is someone who you're confident about giving your information, and perhaps you've dealt with before, but there's still those issues there. And so issues about actually delivering the goods to you, which have nothing to do with us directly, are also very important in that area. The other thing that we find is, and this is within the European single market, is that consumers would like to shop and access the power of the marketplace across 27 countries. They may find a very interesting product, service at a cheaper price they can buy locally. But a recent survey by the Commission showed that only just over two-thirds, it was about, I think, 40% of transactions, they were actually able to complete because the supplier wouldn't actually deal with them because the supplier was worried about whether he was going to get paid or whether he was going to comply with the laws in which the consumers were at their expectations, or whether there were differences in consumer law that he had to contend with. So we are working on those sort of issues at the moment, and there's a general provision under the EU single market law about providing service, which says in general terms that you shouldn't discriminate in provision of a service in either price or type of service between one country and another. Now, that isn't actually brought into play, but it's something that I think will be looked at in the evolution of the single market. So we are trying to tackle these things, but in the end, as Pablo has pointed out, of course, if you're dealing with different languages and different cultures, and in many ways different approaches to intellectual property, countries which still have, for example, levies on certain types of electronic equipment, you know, that remains a fragmentary element, and that's certainly something that eventually, I think, will be dealt with. And the Commission has published a report last week about music rights and collecting society activities to encourage pan-European rights clearance for people who want to use music and distribute music on a pan-European scale on the internet. So I think we will make incremental progress on these things, and there will be a combination of things that will be things that that can be handled, if you like, within what you might call internet-based regulation, but there will also be a lot of stuff that will be dealt with outside any sort of digital context. There will be about things that make the market work. Well, I'm not so involved in the ITU discussions. I was previously. But again, I would be a bit surprised if we were moving to the stage where there was going to be that sort of commonality of regulation. And I don't think it's not within the purview of the ITU to decide that anyway. is certainly something that will be debated at the forthcoming Internet Governance Forum, I'm sure, about that. But it does seem to me that it's rather premature to legislate for harm which I think is not at all evident. And anticipatory legislation in an expectation that consumers may be done harm doesn't seem to me a particularly good principle. It's something that historically Europe has sometimes been criticized for, I think, inappropriately in areas like food safety, for example. But it seems to me in such a fast-moving area like the Internet, it's not that appropriate. But, I mean, I come back to the broader point, though, that I think that people are much more attracted by the European model, anyway, of having open access to networks. In other words, actually having competition and encouraging consumers to have choice and to be able to switch easily and to have lots of transparent information. And I think that's something that consumers and countries would really benefit from everywhere, whether it's in India and Russia and particularly in China. So I think philosophically that aspect is something that Europe will promote very strongly in those sort of arenas.
This idea, though, of that the ITU may somehow try to exert authority over the Internet, I mean, obviously U.S. policymakers are sort of united opposing
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
You know, is the U.S. and the EU, would you like to see greater, like, I don't know if there is right now, but, you know, some of those forces?
There has been a huge amount of cooperation at all these forums. I mean, I was involved in this originally at the 2003 Information Society Summit in Geneva, and I went to the first Internet Governance Forums. And throughout that time, the US and the European Union have collaborated intensively on essentially wanting an entirely open and independent global governance system for the Internet. And one of our meetings today, we went to see Phil Webbier's team in the State Department to discuss those very issues in forthcoming forums. So there is the ITU forum in Dubai, there's the Internet Governance Forum coming up. And I think that continues to be an extremely strong political position between the two sides. She's going to speak in Spanish and then we'll have her.
Yeah. I think that one possibility.
green, and I'm agreeing. You didn't say it, but I'm agreeing that the digital format is going to be more than physical format in the future. Thanks to many things, but also thanks probably to the green concept that it has. I think that we are promoting that. So for example, we have innovation is the key of promoting the things on internet. The DLT is like that because we have a problem. We have a problem in Europe that, in my opinion, is the beginning of the problems of the situation that we have now in internet or in e-commerce in Europe. The problem is that we didn't pay enough attention to the potential of internet in the last years. So, and I'm going to explain this. We used to live, for example, technology in, for example, with mobile telephones. Okay, we used to have Nokia. We have it. Nokia was the leader of the world 7 years ago, and in mobile terminals, we were 10 years in advance of others. Now, 7 years later, Nokia is a terminal that nobody wants as a first option. As a first option. And well, in Europe, I do the experiment all the time, but we can do it here also. If we can, if we ask here, who has a Nokia?
I have a Nokia.
Less, I'm telling you, less than 5% of the people here. Less than 5%. And the one that has Nokia, probably, he didn't innovate. It's a regular
product as well.
But that's the problem that we have. Nokia lose the place, his place in the world, in the digital economy, probably because they didn't innovate. Who is leading now this sector? Probably Apple. What happens with Apple? The same thing. I mean, Apple begins with thanks to the innovation. Steve Jobs was a genius in innovation terms. After he started a company that was competing with GM at that time, that was IBM, they fired him from the company, and the company stopped innovation. And the company, in the years without innovation and without Steve Jobs, were immersed in many problems. The action, I think it was $20 or something like that. Then they decide to get Steve Jobs again, and they decide to bet for innovation. And now Apple is the first company in the world. The action is higher than $500. So, well, the problem that we have in Europe is that we didn't pay attention to the potential of internet, and you have the United States have done that much better than we have. About the question of increase the attention in the internet because it's green, because it's many other factors, we are doing it. I mean. When I become a member of the European Parliament 3 years ago, the European institutions were talking about e-commerce, about the future of our economy. And in my opinion, it's not the future, it's the present. So in 3 years, we have changed that perspective a lot. And now we have in the Commission one commissioner that is only taking care of the single digital market, that is Commissioner Neelie Kroes, but it's not a regular commissioner, it's a vice president of the commission. Just to mention the importance that we are giving to the digital market. And in the parliament, for example, thanks to the collaboration and the importance that we think that this has in the INCO committee, we have made a working group on e-commerce. person in digital market, and we have also innovated in that working group. I think, and Malcolm is here to correct myself because it's my first term, so that is the first time that a working group from the European Parliament has not only members as a permanent members of that working group, it has also the Commission as a permanent member with, if the topic is one thing, they send one general direction from the Commission, or other if we change the topic. But there are permanent members, and also we have all the people involved in e-commerce as permanent members there, just to share with us their experience, because what we think is that we don't know how the digital world is, and we need to hear from the experience and learn from the experience, so we can after that legislate in the different topics or to defeat the different problems that we have in the. But for sure, the digital economy is one of the most important things that we have on the table right now in the economy. In my opinion, also I can tell you that that is my opinion. That the way out of the crisis, it has also a digital format for the things that I told you before. The consumption is stopped, and if we want to grow, we must reactivate the consume in Europe. So if we want to do that, we probably need the same standards of quality, lower prices. We need to do things faster because life goes very fast, and internet is a very good tool to do that. So, in my opinion, it's a very good tool to help to go out of the crisis. I'm going just to share with you one thing that probably Martin is not going to. I was just concerning about a thing that we have an idea that we have shared with the different people that we have shared different thoughts here that were representative of the Congress, Senate, the U.S. Trade, and it was about the roaming tariffs. As you know, m-commerce is the future, is probably the present now with the smartphones and tablets. And for an European citizen to go to, came over to the US with a smartphone, for example, it happens to me this trip, is a problem because the roaming tariffs are too high. But just to make you an idea, 1 megabyte in my smartphone with the roaming tariff, it means almost 15 euros. So, and it's something that I want to share with you because I think it should be a good opportunity to start talking in both sides of the Atlantic to make the construction of bridges just to trade between each other, because I think that we are losing our place in the world in this new digital era. So the roaming tariffs is probably just a stupidity, but I think it should be a good start for helping in doing good things and placing the both sides of the Atlantic just to compete with other places like the countries from Asia, like China or India or whatever. But I think it should be a good